While the accomplishments of known white supremacists are still documented, framed, and distributed, both historical and ongoing racism in Abbotsford remains hushed. This creates tension between white and non-white people in the valley and can have dire consequences. Why is nobody talking about it? And what does this silence say about the community? This country was born out of the violent seizure of land that belonged to indigenous people across Turtle Island, and the systems that it's built upon continue to disenfranchise black people, indigenous people, and people of color every day. Abbotsford is the homeland of the Stolo, or the people of the river, now represented formally through the Sumas First Nation and the Matsqui First Nation. I'm recording this show on Coast Salish land, stolen from the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples, and I'm grateful to live and work here. I'm Ali Laube for CIVL Radio, and this is Abbotsford's Hushed History of Racism. This series was funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiative. To find the print and blog posts of this and other content from the Local Journalism Initiative, visit canada-info.ca. This content might include some explicit language. As a researcher at the University of the Fraser Valley, Olivia Daniels has noticed a divide between the white and brown students who go to school there. A post made this year saying that there were too many immigrants at UFE was met with a disturbing amount of support online, spurring Black Connections, a UFE-based group for supporting Black culture and excellence, to respond on their Facebook page, recalls Daniels. That online hate looked very familiar to the racism she studied in old Abbotsford newspapers, she says.
There seems to be a strong divide between people that are from Punjab, right? They come here, they study, and then the domestic students feel like there's too many of these foreign students here. And so people get afraid of the music they're listening to and why don't they talk to us and things like that. This concern of too many people coming in from a foreign place sounds like a lot of the same feelings that people felt back then.
She says these harmful ideologies must be disrupted so they aren't passed down to the younger generations, as they have been.
When the Abbotsford Historical Society recognized Ian's findings of that one article, if you look at their anti-racism message on their website, they phrase it very this was a one-time thing. But my paper is kind of strongly opposing that and saying, no, this was a reoccurring thing the community liked to do and spoke highly of, and there would be hundreds of people that would show up. One of the lectures that were held, there was hundreds of people that showed up, or the festival, on Essendine, it was a couple of hundreds of people. These were popular mainstream events, so it's definitely not a one-time incident.
In a 2015 article for Vox, journalist Janae Desmond-Harris wrote that microaggressions are more than just insults, insensitive comments, or generalized jerky behavior. There's something very specific, the kinds of remarks, questions, or actions that are painful, because they have to do with a person's membership in a group that's discriminated against, or subject to stereotypes. And a key part of what makes them so disconcerting is that they happen casually, frequently, and often without any harm intended, in everyday life. Saying, "Where are you from?" or "You speak good English" can sound like you are a foreigner and you don't belong here. Saying, "I don't see race," denies a person of color's experiences and essentially assimilates them into the dominant culture. These are just a few examples of microaggressions. Yet, we still feel the repercussion of this history today, where white supremacy survives in different, harder-to-see forms. Rajneesh Dewan is an associate professor with the Department of English at UFV and a playwright. He distinguishes two types of racism that he's seen at work, hate-based and ignorance-based. The latter is more common in his experience. For example, people who don't know he has a PhD will ask him if he's a recent immigrant from India or why he's good at speaking English. Once, another teacher asked him if he was a student while he was eating lunch in the faculty lounge, as a nearly 50-year-old man. In the classroom, students have complained about the Vaisakhi parade. Letters to the editor express concern about Vaisakhi, but never the Christmas parade. The list could go on, says Dewan.
See, our mindset is still in the colonial bent. I mean, it will be. We still have a queen, so whatever. The significance is, again, it's a normalization. the colonial slash whiteness is still normal. That is the normal, everything else is still outside of the purview.
Part of the reason why racist microaggressions like this are still so common in the Valley is because it's segregated, Dawan says. The line that separates West, brown, Abbotsford, from East, white, Abbotsford, is arbitrary and racially motivated, he says. In response, he encourages people to be more curious and open about one another's cultures and belief systems.
Art and culture is the, for me, I think this is the first step in terms of intercultural, intercommunity dialogue. Once you start talking, you become comfortable. There is so much misperception about the people of color that can be easily erased with a little bit of promotion of art and culture. Young people are very willing to do new stuff, but there's a reluctance in the older generation towards it. So we need to take that step, not like those multicultural festival where, you know, the only thing about India is about Bhangra dancing and samosa eating. No, not like that. We need complex themes in terms of art, in terms of music, going beyond the stereotyping. The moment you get rid of that, then the real face starts coming. And Abbotsford needs to invest in getting rid of the stereotyping aspect within the art and culture thing also. When it's tokenism, people just feel good for that thing one day and then they forget about it. They don't learn. So get rid of tokenism, get rid of stereotyping, and get to the essence of art and culture and other aspects of it.
Folks in Abbotsford should also try to understand other belief systems like Sikhism and Buddhism, since they coexist already in the city, says Dawan. He sees Abbotsford as a Bible Belt, where religion is a primary concern for most residents. And with that in mind, he says that people of all faiths need to learn to respect one another.
If your idea is that, you know, if you don't believe in my system, then you're condemned or you're damned or you're going to hell or whatever that place is, then you are always going to feel superior from the other. And the fact remains that most of the, it's not that brown people are not Christians, but the majority of the Christian people are white. Most of the brown people are not Christians. So it's the idea of I am better than you, if it's rooted in the very foundation of your belief, then it's going to be transcribed into the race aspect as well. Abbotsford needs to work towards building bridges in terms of respecting whatever the other person is believing, or, you know, like in me, not believing at all. Respect that. End of story.
That's just one suggestion from one leader. Canada's education system also has a part to play in the racism in Abbotsford and across the country. And it's important to remember that generations of students have been taught whitewashed histories. Educational materials on Abbotsford's history largely exclude people of color, aside from irregular documentations, which exist mostly to frame white settlers as generous patrons to more recent immigrants. The vice president of Black Connections, a club at U of V that fosters a greater community for Black people in Abbotsford, Mark Forcier, is focused on reforming the education system. He says there needs to be more Black history in K-12 curriculum everywhere in Canada, including Abbotsford. He wants to become a teacher, so he can shape those curricula himself and act as a role model for Black students.
In terms of wars and how much we learn about that in, say, social studies, again, or history class, Black erasure is completely there, but it's like Black Canadians and Black Americans also fought in World War II. It's World War II. It's not the Great White War 1 and 2, you know? Like, we were there. So many other people were a part of this world war. So how about we start including that in the curriculum too, and then really get into how it is? Because from that point on, you could get into how peace treaties are developed and how people have to understand other cultures and get into, like, what was the root to cause all these things. But no, because you want to continue on these narratives that we, the majority group, kicked ass with no help, that's just such a lie. It does no good for students not to tell the truth, especially students of color. Because though we go through the regular curriculum, we're asking ourselves so many more questions too. Just how this can be the truth, but we're not a part of the truth. At least that's a question as a student I'd ask myself in those classes.
He was constantly othered at school growing up, which didn't change when he started going to the University of Victoria.
I can tell you one course that really blew my mind. Social studies, you do a couple days of Black History during Black History Month in February. But I remember going to one of my first year courses at UVic, African American History was the course. And I remember for one of the assignments, we got to spend about 30 minutes or something on a website that discussed lynchings and how lynchings were a public or social event. You'd bring your friends out to a lynching, and then you would take photos, and then you would send those photos of lynched Black bodies to your friends. So I had to sit through a class as the only Black student in that class. University, though, so though hard, I'm happy I learned it because I didn't know about it because my high school didn't teach me about it. And I don't think middle school should, but I feel like you should get a whiff of that kind of information in high school. And I was never taught that.
In 1804, Haiti had a revolution and became the only slave nation to defeat its masters in the history of slavery. He would have loved to learn about that and wants children in the system now to have access to that history so that they're empowered.
In the history of slavery, it is the only victory of slaves over their masters. Even back then, they knew it too, and they suppressed it. They suppressed the crap out of that history from spreading, because if that news had spread amongst all the colonies, you'd have rebellions all over. You'd have slave rebellions all over because the slave nation didn't. So they suppressed it. Now, if you still teach future children of that history, they're going to be empowered. They'll be empowered to do things. They'll know what they're currently experiencing is a lie or unjust. The Haitian Revolution is not taught about in history books. You tell me that at age 8, I'm going to be empowered. My people did that. There's a dominant narrative going on, and it's the white narrative. And I said white, not right. For Black people, there's no point in the past that's good unless you go to like pre-European colonial aspects before the Arabic slave trade. Like maybe that might be a good time for us, but all that history is lost or stolen and hidden somewhere.
The city let Black Connections down this year, says Forcier. They had a partnership with City Studio, where the club would create a public Black Lives Matter mural in Abbotsford, but that never happened. The mural was supposed to be on the ground permanently, but at the last meeting before the artist went forward, the deal changed.
And then it was told at the last meeting that it was going to be there on the ground for 2 months. So we'd have this Black Lives Matter mural there for 2 months, and then after that we'd have like panel discussions, kind of some surveys, blah blah blah, to figure out if the community wanted and or needed a Black Lives Matter mural in Abbotsford. So at that point we just pulled our club out of it. I discussed it with the president, and then we were just like, we're out. We were brought on with the understanding that it was going to be a permanent mural.
Forcier was the only person of color on the board for this mural project, which he says was otherwise constituted by wanting to do good women. But Black Lives Matter is not a message that's up for debate, Forcier says.
How am I supposed to return to my community, like members of my community, my team really, and tell them, hey, I know I pushed so hard to have us join this group so we could get this mural, and I know you guys all said don't do it. You were right. You have to have some hope. You're like, this group might be the one to actually see something through. We're going to see things through because we need it. And we're not going to let others stop us. But we do need the help of others, too.
Allison Gutrath is the Diversity Education Program Supervisor at Archway Community Services. Under that role, she provides project management for the Local Immigration Partnership Project, a program focused on creating a welcoming and inclusive community within Abbotsford for newcomers who are living in Canada. She also works on Archway's Resilience BC projects, which are related to their Fraser Valley Human Dignity Commission, a group dedicated to doing anti-racism work in the community. Archway accepts reports from people who have experienced racism and discrimination through online submission, phone, or email. After submissions are made, they follow up with the people who send it in to see what kind of support, resources, and referrals they need. When they track those incidents, they share them with the provincial government. Gutrath has been working in the Diversity Education Program for over 20 years and has seen racist hate crimes ebb and flow during that time. At the beginning of 2020, she noticed a rise in anti-Asian racism. They started getting more reports from people who felt targeted by racial slurs and racist notices posted around the city, which continued into the spring. With the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement in May, things started to change. Archway saw a significant increase in the number of reports they were receiving, about 8 in a 2-week period from the end of May to the middle of June. The rate has, quote, dropped off somewhat, unquote, since then, she says, which Gutrath hopes is due to more community support and anti-racism education.
There have been some pretty hurtful incidents, a newcomer being targeted with racial slurs and having something thrown at them outside of a store, and being told, go back to where you came from. There are definitely people who are racist towards newcomers and discriminate against them in our community. But then I would say that there are people who are welcoming and are trying to be more inclusive. You know, in the past 10 to 15 years or so, there has been this development of racism towards the west side of Abbotsford, where people assume it's mostly South Asian people and families that are living in the west side of Abbotsford. And there are, I've heard, racist comments made about that part of town, about people living there. I've heard comments that realtors will tell people who are buying a house in Abbotsford, well, you don't want to buy over there. There is some significant racism that's happening around people's perceptions of different parts of our community, of different neighborhoods and such. At the same time, it's not true.
Yeah.
Not every single person living on a street is necessarily all one ethnicity or speaks all one language. And people of a certain ethnicity are not necessarily all newcomers either. South Asian people were working at the mill. And so we have second generation, third generation Canadians who are South Asian in our community. They're not all newcomers either. The fact that people, you know, might choose to live in a neighborhood where they connect with the people, and maybe they have a similar ethnic background, maybe they have a similar language, or, you know, maybe even religious or faith affiliation, that is partly for comfort, and mm-hmm. it's also a community thing. So it's not necessarily a bad thing when someone wants to live in an area where they feel like they fit in a certain way, right? It could be to do with age, it could be to do with ethnicity or race or language. People who are needing to learn more about what racism is, and, you know, what is systemic racism, what is institutionalized racism, and where do I fit in with that? That is something that takes quite some time, and it takes some dedication on a person to learn more about it. I know that I have inherent privilege because of the color of my skin, and I have to work hard at remembering that, at confronting that, and also learning and working every day on how I can be a better ally to Black, Indigenous, and people of color in our community.
Naming white supremacy in Abbotsford is crucial, advocates say. That can start with residents and culminate in meaningful change. On the next episode of Abbotsford's Hushed History of Racism, we will talk about the importance of religion to creating a white supremacist environment in Abbotsford. I'm Allie Laube for Civil Radio. Thanks for listening.